Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what we think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. One of the people that I enjoy working with most in that battle space is the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, my friend and colleague, and frequent co-host and regular contributor to this segment of our program, Fred Grandy, former member of Congress, former star of stage and screen, and among other things, a professional talk radio show host, so he really knows what he's doing in this space. And Fred, we have always got a lot to talk about, but particularly this week, I want to take advantage of your myriad expertises, if I can use that phrase, as a politician, as a talker, as a pundit and analyst. What did you make of the first presidential debate between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama this week?
Well, I guess I'm like a lot of people that have kind of been watching with gritted teeth and clenched fists as the Romney campaign at least appeared to be falling behind. But I think with that debate, I think, and I'm putting this mildly because I don't put as much stock perhaps in debates as perhaps some of the punditry does, but I do think this was a course correction for Romney. And the thing that I liked, all of the topics aside, were his ability to control the agenda and get the president to answer him. This is what debates are about. It's not so much about the content. It's about the control of that content, and that's what Romney did throughout. Now, obviously, this being a debate about the economy, a lot of our topics were not touched upon, but I couldn't help noticing there was a very interesting exchange between Romney and the president over defense cuts, which Romney absolutely rejected out of hand and said so on a couple of occasions, while the president responded with what I thought was a pathetic excuse and one I hadn't even heard, saying, well, the Defense Department wants $2 trillion, or the Republicans are asking for $2 trillion in cuts, which the Defense Department hasn't asked for. Well, you and I both know
and doesn't want. And doesn't want, he actually said.
Yeah. But Leon Panetta has said on the record, we cannot survive this level of defense cutting. So I'm just wondering where the president's taking his advice.
Well, we know where he's taking his advice. It's from the Valerie Jarretts and the David Axelrods. And I think his own instincts are to gut the military to the extent he can, redistribute it so that it can be doing good things, peace dividends and all that. But frankly, a redistribution of power in the world that is, as we've talked about most weeks, very troubling. Fred, I was struck. One of the reasons why Mitt Romney was able to do, as you've just said very well, control the debate is because the moderator got out of the way. And Matt Cottinetti at the Washington Free Beacon today has a very interesting piece about how the left that had almost without exception, I think, lionized Jim Lehrer, the moderator in this debate, for many years as kind of an iconic newsman figure, very much a man of the left, but has now turned on him as cannibals would, excoriating him for not controlling the debate and denying Mitt Romney the opportunities to show the president in an unfavorable light and in a way, leave the president exposed in the fashion that you've just described.
You know,
is that
my
how you
reaction
see it?
To that, Frank, is when push comes to shove with liberals and left-leaning organizations, they revert to gangland behavior. Jim Lehrer, to at least in the minds of a lot of those individuals, was a made man. He was never going to betray the mob. But essentially, as you said, he got out of the way and let the candidates control the debate. And by the way, that was the format that he announced at the outset. What I was pleased to see is he actually practiced what he preached. But the Democrats, who were so used to having moderators usually run interference for them downfield, all of a sudden found themselves having to compete with their opponent. and having no allies behind the other side of the microphone. So
and no
I was
teleprompter.
Delighted to see that Lehrer did what he did.
Yeah, and no teleprompter either. Let me switch gears on you. Fred Grandy, again, is our guest. He is a co-host of this program and a executive vice president of the Center for Security Policy these days, for which we're very grateful. Let me ask you about your take on this Libyan attack, Fred, that took place, of course, on the 11th of September. We've been learning more and more and more about it, but one of the most interesting things to me, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, is that it seems that what the intelligence community of the United States government learned within about 24 hours or so of the attack was that what the Obama administration continued to characterize it as, namely as a sort of spontaneous a demonstration in response to this video, was not true.
No, and I guess what I look at as I watch this is just how long the administration thinks that they can attempt to massage this. Because as I look at this, I keep thinking, well, you know, it's hard to really say the cover-up is going to be worse than the crime here because four people died, including our ambassador. But to insist on these lame defenses for not providing security in one of the most threatening areas in the world. I mean, apparently, Ambassador Stevens was told not even to do his morning runs in Tripoli. That's how dangerous the country was. And, of course, it rises exponentially the closer you get to Benghazi. Now we're learning that they were even denied an aircraft to fly some of their security people around the country. So you have to ask yourself, was the administration just naive, or was there another agenda here where they were purposely trying to leave this facility unfortified? I don't know.
Well,
but
what we do know,
they have to answer.
Yeah, what we do know, Fred, is that apparently the ambassador and others with him were asking through channels for more security and were denied it by the Obama administration for reasons that aren't entirely clear. But, Fred, I want to just drill down on this with you because I think, you know, the work that that you're involved with at the Center for Security Policy is very much relevant to this. The administration's meme that there has been really nothing except what we provoked here through permitting this this untoward, reprehensible, disgusting video, call it what you will, is really very much of a piece with the Muslim Brotherhood and Organization of Islamic Cooperation agenda that no one may blaspheme against Islam. And I just want to find out from you whether with, you know, your experience in Washington, your deep understanding of this Sharia supremacist enterprise, whether it willingly or unwittingly, the Obama administration isn't playing directly into the hands of those who would strip us effectively of our First Amendment right to free expression and otherwise embolden the enemy at a very dangerous time.
Well, it is a dangerous time, obviously, in terms of security, and we've already seen the consequences of that lapse, but it's also a very dangerous time politically for the president, because as we begin to learn more about this and we watch the campaign proceed to the election day, what seems to be clear, and more I think that watch what's unfolding are beginning to arrive at this conclusion, it seems that this administration, and specifically this president, is more interested in protecting Muslim sensibilities than American lives. And I don't know how he can possibly sustain that argument.
Let me ask you
specifically.
The more
that people bring this out, and I'm hoping the Romney campaign will, I think this will be a devastating political consequence for the president.
I agree with you. Let me ask you quickly about one individual that they have had front and center in this past week in Warsaw at a human rights conference, a Muslim Brotherhood-associated individual by the name of Salam Amariati, ostensibly there to espouse freedom of speech, but also to signal sensitivity about this blasphemy business. What's that about?
Well, I can't understand why he was appointed, except that apparently he had the blessing of the of the Helsinki Commission, which, as you know, is kind of the congressional and executive our version of the OSCE, the Committee for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So I don't know how he was able to run the traps, but I do know this. Salam Mariotti's reputation as a somewhat suspect actor goes back at least 10 years, when no less a person than Richard Gebhardt originally appointed him to a high-level government panel and then rescinded that when he learned about his connections to Hamas. So this guy has been made, and he's also the head of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, which we know, along with CARE and ISNA, constantly is arguing for these kinds of strictures.
Well, let me put a fine point on it. He's a Muslim brother.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
It's a special privilege to have with us for this segment Dr. Raymond Stock, truly one of our country's most, I think, knowledgeable and certainly experienced experts on the Middle East, its culture, its ideology, notably Sharia. And he comes to us having served and lived for 20 years in Cairo from 1990 to 2010. I admire him greatly, not only for his understanding of this subject matter, but his courage in speaking truthfully about it, something that has kept him out of Egypt now as a result. Dr. Stock, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Frank.
You have been writing and thinking and commenting now for quite some time in connection with your fellowship with the Middle East Forum, most especially, about what Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt, is up to. And I thought we might start our conversation there. I saw that he's recently released a terrorist implicated in a horrific
terrorist attack in Luxor that you've written about very evocatively. He is seeking the release of yet another terrorist, the blind sheikh here. Who is this Morsi character, and what agenda is he pursuing both there and here?
Well, Mohammed Morsi has been a major figure in the Muslim Brotherhood since the 1990s. He studied engineering. He has a doctorate in engineering from the United States, from California. He also has sons who are American citizens, perhaps other children as well, but perhaps daughters. I'm not sure. But he definitely has all the necessary qualifications to practice the perfect strategy of civilizational jihad, because he understands both sides very well. But he's also, despite, or perhaps even because of, and this goes back to the experience of someone else, Syed Qutb, because perhaps of his experience in the United States, because he joined the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States, he does not see us as we see ourselves. He sees us through this particular prism of Islamist ideology. But he knows how to use our language and speak to American media personnel, American media and American politicians and American specialists on the region in a language that reassures them of his intentions. But if you look at his overall record and what he stands for in Egypt, he is known as the ideological hardline enforcer of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Dr. Sak, you've mentioned a couple of terms there that I'd like to drill down on, because they're very important to our understanding of the Muslim Brotherhood and its agenda. Civilizational jihad is a term, of course, that I think listeners to this program are familiar with, but how would you define that, and specifically, how does that jive with the type of jihad or holy war that we're most familiar with, particularly since 9/11, of the more violent stripe?
Well, it is, number one, the idea of Dawah, which is the strategy used by the Muslim Brotherhood to build up its own institutional power in its home base, which is, in this case, Egypt and the Arab world, the Muslim world in general. But in foreign countries, non-Muslim countries, it is to take the jihad that they feel they cannot win through violence to the institutions of those countries by infiltrating and penetrating them, and by getting them to surrender bit by bit to their agenda and to their worldview, and to turn over power to them over a period of time through first subversion and education, and then through, if necessary, force.
This Dawah business is, I guess, loosely at least translated as sort of proselytizing, promoting the faith and so on. You've circulated a very interesting clip by the Middle East Media Research Institute, Memory, a marvelous organization, in which Ayman al-Zawahiri, now the leader of al-Qaeda, formerly the number two to Osama bin Laden, talks about Osama bin Laden's relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood and the kind of jihad that they were anxious to have him perform that really speaks to this point about sort of a division of labor. Tell us a little bit about that background, the relationship between al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is sort of the parent organization to a lot of extremist groups. And in fact, the majority of militant Islamist groups that exist now in the world are in some way or another offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're the sort of the originator, sort of the progenitor of this sort of modern Islamist wave of jihad. And there are very many branches of the Muslim Brotherhood. And in Egypt, for example, the original Muslim Brotherhood was, you know, it was formed in Egypt in Ismailia in 1928 by Hassan al-Banna. By the 1970s, there were groups like Takfir al-Hijra, which basically was the most virulently violent and jihad-oriented, militant jihad-oriented organization in Egypt. At the time, it began to kill government ministers and carry out acts of terror. And through the 1970s and 80s, there was actually a war going on in Egypt that people didn't even know about. Not a war so much as a one-sided slaughter of Christians that was kept out of the press. Now, by the 1980s, you had Al-Gamal Islami and other groups. Actually, this group was the Sheikh Abdurrahman, Omar Abdurrahman, the blind sheikh. It was his organization, the same man who plotted the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and who issued numerous fatwas that led to a great deal of violence, the attempted assassination of Naguib Mahfouz, an Egyptian writer.
who Mohamed Morsi is now trying to spring from American prison, of course.
He's now sitting in North Carolina at a life sentence for his role in those in that conspiracy. But in New York, the New York conspiracy. But he is best known in Egypt for causing a tourist war, a war against tourism and against tourists, against foreigners, against the police and the security forces as well, that killed about 1,000 people in the 1990s, including the Luxor massacre, in which 58 tourists and four policemen and tour guides, et cetera, were killed by one of his units. That was run by this man named Mustafa Hamza from Afghanistan. And he was the person who was just released by Mohamed Morsi recently. This is the one you were referring to earlier.
Staggering. Let me turn quickly, because we're almost out of time, Raymond Suk, and unfortunately we need to get you back for a much more comprehensive tour of these issues in which you have such expertise. Again, our guest is Dr. Raymond Suk of the Middle East Forum, where he is the Shulman Ginsberg Writing Fellow. Talk about one particular manifestation of the civilizational jihad of the Muslim Brotherhood and the role that particularly its kind of nation-state level counterpart, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, is waging against blasphemy in a manner that that offends Islam. Specifically, if you would, stitch this together with how the Obama administration has been seemingly going to great lengths to accommodate this stealth jihad agenda.
President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton supported in last December Resolution 1618 in the United Nations, which calls for basically proscribing any insults to religion. But of course, in the OIC's definition, religion is Islam, and you can be assured they'll be preferentially treated.
Well, they're all about defaming all of the other religions all of the time. But the point is that we're seeing an effort being made to impose this kind of Sharia blasphemy on the rest of us, very much as a sort of leading edge of stealth jihad, I believe.
It's already happened in Europe, and that's from the same strategy, which is to force us to be dhimmis, to force us to submit to Islamic doctrine and Islamic law regarding anything, but beginning with this very obvious symbolic phenomenon, which is the idea of insulting their prophet. And it's the one that sort of it's easy to understand. It's an easy issue to beat us with. Because most people do not know, because they don't cover what happens in their own countries regarding the hypocrisy of their position.
That's really the point. And Raymond Suk, again, this is a subject for a much, much more serious discussion, and I hope we can have it with you very soon. Suffice it to say that what you've described in terms of the agenda of Mohamed Morsi, now the president of Egypt, his relationship and that of his parent organization with violent jihadists as well as these civilization jihadists is the sort of thing that I believe we as Americans must be alive to, must understand, and must reject, even though our government is at the moment going to great lengths to accommodate it. Dr. Raymond Suk, thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and I'd look forward to doing so again very soon. Next up, we're going to speak with Fred Flights about the West's declining deterrent and much more from LitTheDeck.com. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Obama administration has repeatedly disregarded Congress and the law. Now it wants you to pay for the consequences. In July, the Labor Department told defense contractors not to fulfill their statutory obligation to warn employees of layoffs arising from the massive sequestration budget cuts that will kick in, all other things being equal, on January 2nd. The administration's problem is that, under the law, such notices would be handed out just days before the November election. Then, late last month, the administration actually told those businesses that the federal government, meaning us taxpayers, would pay for any costs or liability the companies face from violating the law. This is simply outrageous. The president is not above the law, and he must not be allowed to make us liable for his violating it. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Flights, a senior and very accomplished intelligence professional who is now the driving force behind and managing editor of the Langley Intelligence Group network. Its handle is lignet.com, a terrific resource. We're delighted to have him with us each week to visit about some of the reporting and analysis that Lignet is doing at the moment. Fred, I want to start off with an important story that you're covering concerning the dismantling of the nuclear deterrent of the United Kingdom, one of our major allies and one of the nuclear powers that's actually on our side. We talked yesterday with Mark Schneider about the atrophying of our own deterrent. This is a particularly worrying development at the same time that the United States is seemingly going out of the business of nuclear deterrence. Tell us what the Brits are up to.
Well, Frank, it's good to be here. And this is a very interesting story. The British are confronting enormous budget problems, and it has to do with problems with their domestic economy, their National Health Service, and other things that have put their economy out of whack. But now we have a very small country that's trying to keep up a 21st century military and nuclear deterrent, which is difficult and extremely expensive. The UK currently keeps up its nuclear deterrent by having one of its about 160 Trident submarines at sea at all times, which makes about 120 warheads available to be fired at targets, probably in Russia. Well, right now, they have enormous budget cuts to such an extent that they're not going to have an operational aircraft carrier for several years. So if something goes wrong with Falcons, the Brits are going to have a hard time fighting it. Now they're focusing on the reality that their nuclear deterrent could cost $100 billion to extend beyond its current life. Now, with British politicians and the British public already upset at cuts to the Army and the Air Force, there's not a lot of support for continuing spending on the nuclear deterrent, and they soon have to make a faithful decision on whether they will continue this system, and frankly, they could be determining whether they will still be a state with an active nuclear force.
So they may well, for budgetary reasons, adhere to President Obama's urging that they join the rest of the world, of course, but most especially, it seems, those in the West, including the United States, in heading to a kind of, zero nuclear weapons posture that it seems, at least based on what Mark Schneider was saying, that none of the adversaries of the United States, certainly not the Russians, not the Chinese, not the North Koreans, not the Iranians, are likely to follow suit.
Well, that's right. The Chinese and the Russians are certainly not following suit. And I can't say a lot about this in an unclassified setting, but it's pretty clear that the British nuclear deterrent, which is much smaller than ours, is in trouble. The British public are not going to want ICBM, nuclear ICBMs on their territory. There's a possibility they could have slower cruise missiles with nuclear warheads, but that's not really a solution. That's not a serious nuclear deterrent. It's hard to see, given their budget environment right now, how this system is going to be continued.
Fascinating. Well, we will be following it with you at Lignet, needless to say, Fred Flights. Let me ask you about another subject that you've addressed in your reporting. It indicates that we are doubling down, I think is the term you use, to try to defeat al-Qaeda in Yemen. What's really going on in Yemen at the moment? Is al-Qaeda the problem, or is it a larger and increasingly problematic sort of Islamist threat that is emanating from that nation? And is it wise, as I understand it, to be arming these guys in the hopes of dealing with one part of that problem, namely al-Qaeda?
Well, it's a complicated story. President Hadi, who came into power when President Saleh was agreed to step down last February, he was Saleh's vice president. He was a big fan of drone strikes, and he wants to work with the United States to go after al-Qaeda and other radical jihadists in Yemen. The problem is Hadi is his commitment to democracy is questionable. He has his military is divided with Saleh supporters, including the head of the elite Yemi Guard, which is run by his son. So there's real questions about how he's going to manage this. Like, he's trying to remove members of the armed forces who are not loyal to him, but he has to tread carefully so they don't gang up and try to overthrow him. He has a long way to go to rebuilding the army and retaking ground that the army lost to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and other radical jihadist groups, because Saleh let them take territory, hoping to leverage that to get more assistance from the United States. It is an extremely unstable country, but I think we really are forced to work with the Yemeni government. If we don't, we're ceding this territory to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is al-Qaeda's most formidable franchise.
Fascinating. At the moment where they're certainly seemingly taking over other parts of the world, notably Mali, parts of Nigeria, and who knows, Syria, maybe next, Libya and the like, it seems to be very hard to see how the president could possibly claim that they're on the path to defeat. Our guest again is Fred Flights. He is the managing editor of a terrific resource, Lignet.com. He is a man who has spent 25 years in various capacities in the intelligence community and in the State Department up on Capitol Hill, working for the House Intelligence Committee. He knows his stuff, and it's always great to have a chance to visit with him. Let me ask you about one other aspect of your reporting at the moment, Fred. You've shown us that one of the companies that has been much in evidence as a champion of gaining access to the undersea resources of the Arctic Ocean, namely the French oil company Total, seems to be reconsidering the attractiveness of such operations in what's indisputably an extraordinarily difficult, harsh climate. Tell us what's operating there for the French and what, if anything, it might mean for others who have been, we're told at least, very keen to get into those undersea resources.
Well, Frank, this is an important issue for two reasons. First of all, there are enormous energy resources in the Arctic. And second, this is something we have to look at concerning the controversy over the law of the sea treaty, that American companies are not locked out of these resources by agreeing to a treaty that cordons off an enormous amount of energy that we have to be exploiting. Total has backed away from trying to exploit in the Arctic, mostly because of pressure by environmentalists and fear of bad publicity because of the possibility of a leak. And there are serious challenges operating in the Arctic. For example, Shell recently suspended their efforts to explore off the Alaska coast in the Arctic because some test measures they were running to contain spills failed and actually damaged equipment. But Shell's not canceling, they're just postponing it. But it looks like BP, Shell, and Exxon are determined to continue to drill there, but there's enormous pressure by environmentalists who are trying to convince governments it's not possible. Now, people who we've talked to, contacts we've talked to with Exxon say it is possible to drill up there and that the technology exists to do it, but it's only going to be a technology that some of the best oil majors can accomplish. But I think this is an issue environmentalists will try to exploit, and they'll probably try to exploit to advance the law of the sea treaty.
Which, again, for those of our regular listeners, they're well aware, as you say, Fred, that this is an international agreement that has been promoted for many years on the grounds that without such an international arrangement providing permission to various entities to gain access to international waters and what's beneath them, that it will be impermissible to do so. And I think, as you say, Fred Flights, that is not the case. We can gain access to these waters if we have the technology and the will to do so. It will be very interesting to watch whether ExxonMobil and others proceed into that hazardous and difficult terrain. The riches are there, to be sure, but whether it makes sense on all of these other levels is something I know you'll be following for us at Lignet.com. We look forward to visiting with you about these and other subjects again next week. Fred Flights, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for the important compliment to our own programming on these issues that Lignet.com represents. We're always glad to have you with us. Next up, Bill Gertz takes us inside the ring. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas.
Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz for what is always one of the highlights of our week. He is the guy who takes us inside the ring. The subject and name of his remarkable column published at the Washington Times. He is also a senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon. And Bill, between your reporting at the Times and at the Beacon, there's way too much to talk about. And I know we're going to try to get a separate special appearance by you in the near future. But for the moment, tell us about the really extraordinary speech that Donald Rumsfeld gave at the 30th anniversary celebration of the Washington Times. I'm sorry that I couldn't have been there, but it was a fabulous event, as I understand it. And most especially, as you've described in your column, the secretary really took the gloves off in terms of how we have gotten ourselves in the fix we're in at the moment, with embassies being attacked and diplomatic personnel being murdered and the like. Tell us about it.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Good to be on the show. This was a very important speech by the former defense secretary, and he talked about the Obama administration policies of apology and criticism of the United States as basically being behind the recent unrest and violence that we've seen emerging in the Middle East. And he's been a strong advocate that weakness is provocative, and he really laid it out in a very succinct, very sophisticated way. It was very refreshing to finally hear an official come out and lay out in such wonderful terms, and the Times will be running the entire speech as an op-ed very shortly, so I urge everyone to look at that.
In specifically, the secretary spoke about an intolerant ideology, and he really seemed to be challenging the administration over its utter failure to recognize that that's at work, to say nothing of what the administration has been doing now systematically to encourage it through its seeming submission to one of that ideology's principal demands, namely that nobody say anything that it finds offensive about it or Islam or Muhammad or anybody else.
Right. Rumsfeld traced this these policies of appeasement and conciliation to this 2009 speech by Obama in Cairo, where he basically criticized the United States. He said the problem wasn't Islam and this militant terrorist ideology. He said it was the United States. And, you know, that people need to understand that. That's what the president said. And this was supposed to usher in a new era of cooperation with the Arab and Muslim world. And in fact, the opposite has happened. What we're seeing is more violence, more anti-American outbursts, and the rise of regimes that have absolutely opposite values to what the United States holds dear and true, the ideals of freedom and democracy.
Right. No, as you describe it, he put it, the problem is not America, but the intolerant backward ideology of radical Islamists that is at odds with the ideals of freedom and equality. I couldn't agree more. That ideology, as we discuss often here, Bill, as you know, is Sharia, according to its adherents. And it is clearly the case that blaming a provocateur video maker, as Don Rumsfeld said, is misplacing the blame entirely. Bill, let me turn to something else that you wrote about in your Inside the Ring column this week, namely how adherence to this ideology in Iran, namely the mullahs and the government of Iran, are engaged in what even the Joint Staff Intelligence Directorate, as you've reported, is now acknowledging is a, quote, covert war being waged against the West, unquote. What is so striking about this is it's manifesting itself in a number of different ways. Talk to us a little bit about that covert war, the hacking attacks that we're seeing, and Iran's involvement as well as Egypt's in the terrorist attacks in North Africa.
Yeah, this is an emerging story. The Iranian leadership has made clear that as a result of the West's efforts to shut down covertly the Iranian nuclear program, they are now engaged in their own covert war. And a new element of that that just emerged last month is the fact that Iranians have been conducting cyber attacks on U.S. financial institutions, including Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup. And they even attempted to breach the New York Stock Exchange. So we're seeing this sign of a new attack. I reported in The Ring that what hasn't been revealed is that the Iranians are using Hezbollah, the Lebanese terrorist group, as a proxy in conducting these cyber strikes. And we had some details on that, just a one sentence that was contained in a Treasury Department statement made public in February that the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and Security was actually training Hezbollah operatives to conduct cyber attacks. And now we're starting to see those cyber attacks against American financial institutes. Very troubling development.
Well, it is. And Bill, you've laid out in the remarkable piece that you've written today in the Washington Free Beacon about how American intelligence is now increasingly furious with the Obama administration for what seems to be, according to your reporting at least, increasing evidence that there's a cover-up going on with respect to what the intelligence community knew and when it knew it about Iranian and, as I say, Egyptian involvement in terrorism in North Africa. We won't have time to do justice to this, and I do want to hit one other thing with you before we let you go, but give us a very quick distillation of what you've reported.
Basically, the Obama administration according to U.S. officials, engaged in its own type of disinformation campaign by putting out this false story that the recent violence, including the September 11th attack in Benghazi, Egypt, against our consulate that killed the ambassador
in Libya,
three others, was in fact a Al-Qaeda-inspired attack, but they said it was only a spontaneous uprising against a Muslim film, and the reason was is because the president, in his convention address, said that Al-Qaeda is declining, when in fact there is large amounts of intelligence, both technical and human, indicating that we're seeing just the opposite, that Al-Qaeda is surging. It's surging in Egypt, and from Egypt in particular, a university called Al-Azhar University, and they're sending Al-Qaeda operatives into Libya and into Syria and other parts of the world.
Yeah, and there are large swaths of countries, notably Mali, Syria, and Iraq and Libya and elsewhere, where they're very much now on the march. No path for defeat in evidence. And Bill Gertz, I want to salute you for saying the unsayable, or what really needs to be said, at least, about this disinformation campaign. We'll have you back shortly to address what you've discovered and the various aspects of this very troubling story in the near future. But before we let you go, we've been talking all week about some reporting you've also been doing at the Free Beacon, Bill Gertz, about the Chinese efforts to hack into sensitive American infrastructure, specifically the White House military office. Tell us what you know about that and how serious a threat this represents to our security.
This is another extremely important story. The White House is trying to minimize the fact that hackers believed linked to the Chinese government were able to penetrate the White House military office, which is one of the most sensitive government agencies in the country. They're in charge of all presidential communications, communications among top officials, and most importantly, the nuclear football, that is the command and control suitcase used by the president if there were a nuclear war. And this attack occurred last month, and again, it was played down, and the president wasn't notified about it because they claimed that they had mitigated the damage. The White House is claiming it was only an unclassified system, when in fact, any information in that computer, which was almost certainly lost, would provide reconnaissance for the Chinese to conduct other strikes and try to get at the more sensitive information. Very troubling development. The FBI is currently investigating.
Bill Gertz, nobody investigates it better than you do. Thank you very much for joining us today and each week with your reports on what you are covering inside the ring at the Washington Times. Thank you again for the myriad books on these subjects and all the other work that you do in this space, Bill. It's deeply appreciated. Come back to us again early next week to talk more about this cover-up of the Obama administration on North Africa and more, and I hope the rest of you will do so as well. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.